You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, a look inside the intriguing lives of social insects like ants and bees. In 1991, my next guests won the Pulitzer Prize for their joint effort, a book called The Ants. It gave us an up-close look at these cooperative social creatures, as familiar as a picnic lunch or as foreign as the deepest, darkest jungle, and it laid out the scientific thinking for how these creatures were shaped by natural selection and evolution. Well, now the prize-winning duo is back with a new book, The Super Organism. It picks up where the ants left off, and it includes other social insects, wasps, termites, honeybees. Joining me now to talk about it are my guests, Edward O. Wilson, better known as E.O. Wilson, co-author of The Super Organism, The Beauty, Elegance, and Strangeness of Insect Societies. He is the Pellegrino University Research Professor Emeritus at Harvard, and he's here in our studio in New York. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Also with us is his co-author, Dr. Bert Holdobler. He is co-author of The Super Organism. He is a foundation professor at Arizona State University in Tempe. He's here in our studio. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Holdobler.
Well, glad to be here.
I have to ask you about you sat through the last conversation and listened about people's activities. Any of that surprise you in comparison to ants or bees or anything?
I intuitively felt that was a reasonable result. And if you try to extend it to ants, then, of course, with some colonies having millions of workers and they're all close together, we must have some of the happiest creatures on Earth.
And they show it. let's talk about what is a superorganism? Well, how do you define that?
It's not easy to define in a short sentence, but let me try. If you have a group of organisms which live together and they are so tightly organized and united that they develop collectively traits which are similar to traits of an ordinary organism, we can call such groups superorganisms. And there are not many examples in the animal world which we can really call superorganisms, but the eusocial insects are truly social insects are such examples, and this is the topic of the book. We show how during evolutionary time from more primitive eusocial systems with lots of friction within the society, revolution going on within the society, they finally reach the state, evolutionary state, of the ultimate superorganism, which is for us, for example, the leafcutter ants or many of the other highly organized insect societies.
Dr. Wilson, why is the leafcutter the ultimate?
Well, Bert and I designated that as the pinnacle, the gold medal winner, so to speak, along with another group of organisms that we both have worked on, weaver ants of Africa and Asia. And the reason why we say ultimate is the enormous complexity of the caste systems. Mm-hmm. The physical caste systems, which in the case of the leafcutters, range all the way from, tiny ants up to giant soldiers and even more gigantic queens, forming colonies of up to 3 million or more, organized by large number of chemical signals passed back and forth, taste and smell, that allows these creatures to not only live a very complicated life, but build a very complicated and, once again, gigantic nest, and also to make their living by agriculture, by taking bits of leaves and other fresh vegetable matter, processing it in a complex way, and then raising fungus, a symbiotic fungus found only with them on it, and that's how they make their living, and they're enormously successful.
And when you both refer to a super organism, you're saying, as you did point out, that it's the whole colony of could be millions of ants. They're acting like one individual higher, let's say, primate or something. Like they have all the different functions, but they're all specialized by different workers.
Well, what we really have to take account is that you have this and this remarkable division of labor
right.
of one individual, the gigantic queen, or as we call it, the reproductive unit. And the
and
million,
she's very busy, you talk
she's,
about.
She's very busy laying eggs.
Yeah.
Thousands sometimes in a day. And, you know, such a leafcutter ant queen lives about 10 to 20 years and produces in her lifetime 250 million offspring.
When does she come up for air?
Well, she never does.
She,
it's a good question
yeah.
because she lives deep down, several meters deep down in the soil. And there's also this gigantic fungus, which produces a lot of oxygen, CO2, what mm-hmm. it is, carbon dioxide. And but these ants, as Ed pointed out, build fantastic nests with an air conditioning system, with a ventilation system to get the oxygen out and get fresh air in. So the queen is always taken care of with this ventilation. But the queen mates only once in her life at the beginning. Then she mates with 5-6 males, stores the sperm in a sperm pocket. So the ants invented the sperm bank long before we humans were on this planet. And as an ant male, you die after you mate it. You have a short, as Ed always called it, they are the flying sperm missiles. But as an ant male, you can become father even 20 years after you died, because the queen has a sperm in her pocket and she can keep these sperms alive down in tropical heat for up to 20 years. Now, just think about what we do to keep our sperm alive. We have these...
We freeze it.
Well, we freeze it with liquid nitrogen and all these techniques.
Right.
You know, it's a great puzzle how these insects do it. And if we ever find out, maybe we can become rich.
Well... Do you think we could figure that out, how they do it?
Oh, well, I'm not sure, pardon me, whether we want to go that direction, because one of the characteristic things about ants is that all of the individuals, all of the working individuals, not including the layabout males who are kept around and disposed of after a short life, but all the individuals are female. And do we want to go in that direction?
I get your point.
I'm a feminist, but I call that liberalism run amok. The point is that, in theory, if we were able to develop the technology and try to answer your question, mm-hmm. Ira, we then would be able to rather easily have store one man's sperm. And in theory, over the, say, 20 years, 30 years after, including after he died, be able to create a population of about the size of New York.
Wow. Talking with Bert Holdobler and E.O. Wilson, author of The Superorganism, The Beauty, Elegance, and the Strangeness of Insect Societies. Now, when we talk about evolution, where is evolution occurring? Is it occurring in the individual ants then, or is the whole colony evolving as a superorganism?
Both. Both. We speak, Ed and I, we advertise the multi-level selection theory so that selection targets different phenotypes, appearances. Of course, the one basic phenotype is the individual. It's not the gene, it's the individual. The individual carries the genes. And the next level is the group, the tightly knit group, the social insect society. It's a phenotype. The more they become this ultimate superorganism, the more they develop colony traits which are evaluated by selection. Those which have traits, collective traits, which are better adapted to a particular environmental condition will be favored. And, of course, they have a genetical basis. Mm-hmm. These genes will spread. And those which have less well-adapted colony traits will not be favored. The ultimate unit of evolution is always a gene. But the target of selection is either the individual, maybe the kin group. I would believe it's the kin group, too. And the group, the insect society.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible for the whole To find a dead end then with some species of ants, they died out because they did not evolve successfully?
You know, this is one of the mysteries of social evolution, that in a group like the ants, which have been around for perhaps 150 million years, think about that, we've been around for maybe, well, as humans, identifiable humans, several million years. And in that great span of time, the ants have proliferated into, well, we know of 14,000 species now, and probably twice that number out there, into an array of social organizations that range all the way from just barely eusocial, you know, small colonies, primitive behavior, all the way up to the giant superorganisms of the leafcutter ants and the these others. So we have yet to really work out, and it may take years, as to as a solution to that dilemma, which is, why haven't they all just gone right to superorganism level?
Interesting. 1-800-989-8255, talking about the new book, The Superorganism, Beauty, Elegance, and Strangeness of Insect Societies. Let's go to Dan in St. Louis. Hi, Dan.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
Great show. I was wondering if your guest had a notion or a model of whether eusocialism, if that's the proper word, had arisen independently, you know, in these numerous ant species and bee species, or if it arose in an ancestor and, you know, these either lost in, you know, the non-eusocial groups. And also, if I could just expand on that just a little bit, is eusocialism, you know, or the superorganism notion, do you have an idea of whether it's like self-organizing, say like a fern, you know, where, you know, one small pattern is just repeated and repeated, and you end up with what looks like a complicated pattern, or is it something more like where, you know, you need outside help to accomplish the level of complexity, like in gene or in protein folding, where you actually need folding other helper proteins?
All right, let me get an answer to those.
Anybody? Okay. Quick answer, farting from the rear and going forward. Yes, it's self-organization. That's the one thing we've been able to establish pretty thoroughly. It's more like a plant, as you say, growing. The cells organize into tissues themselves. They don't have to have some kind of outside influence. Then concerning the origins of, let's use the word eusociality, shall we? It's true, you said socialism. I know you were creating a word there. It is true that socialism is perfected by the ants in one sense of the word, and we like to say that ants prove that socialism works. Marx was right, but he just had the wrong species. However, on the question of how often this has occurred, remarkably few times in the long history of life. It's possible that the superorganism, as broadly defined, of the ants originated only once, about 150 million years ago. And I think that it's apparent that the origin of superorganisms, and this, as Bert Oldober has defined it for us, has occurred only about two dozen times that we know of. Hmm. It's very rare. It's a very difficult level to achieve. And but when it is achieved, as for example in the ants or the termites, then it results in enormous success. A very small number of species come to dominate a large part of the environment.
Talking with Bert Holdoppler and E.O. Wilson, authors of The Superorganism, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Anything, I mean, you've both been at this so long. Does anything surprise you anymore? I mean,
well, we experience all the time new surprises. I tell you, when you compare, there's one chapter just looking at the so-called primitive social systems. When we wrote the ants, nothing was known about that. It's all new, and we got so incredible surprises. For example, we looked at some of these primitive or ancestral eusocial system in ants, and we found that about 80% of all individuals are mated, you know. So the so-called workers can replace a queen and can reproduce. We haven't really known about the revolutions which take place, true revolutions, taking as soon as the reproductive individuals wane in their reproductivity and their fertility, others try to displace them by fighting, by ritualized fighting. It's all new. And you know, when you come to the self-organization, I just have to say one additional word. Self-organization is a word. It doesn't explain very much. It is very good to have a term, but we like to understand which cascades of behavioral acts produce these incredible structures of these nests, for example. Mm-hmm. This is a very similar question in how the brain is organized. We like to understand how the interactions of millions and billions of neurons lead to these structures which produces emergent ability, highly creative abilities. So I think here's the next frontier. To understand, we working on the social insects ask very similar questions what neurobiologists ask. How does the brain work? We don't know yet. How does an insect society work by self-organization? We don't know yet. But it is a true frontier to find out. It must be a cascade of signals because it is not just random. There must be, as Ed said, a plan. But the plan is not in one individual end. The plan is this interactions of individuals which follow a certain program we don't understand yet.
Yeah. Talking with Bert Holdobler and E.O. Wilson, authors of The Superorganism, The Beauty, Elegance, and Strangeness of Insect Societies. If there's one biology book that you should get, this is the great one for, I think, the holiday season. It's a terrific, terrific book. We're going to have to take a short break. We're going to talk more after the break with E.O. Wilson and Bert Holdobler. So stay with us on number 1-800-989-8255. Also, we're Twittering. Our address is at SciFry, if you'd like to send us a question that way. Or in Second Life, we have our island going there and on the phone. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the new book, The Superorganism, The Beauty, Elegance, and Strangeness of Insect Societies, with the authors Bert Holdobler and E.O. Wilson. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Also taking your questions on Twitter at SciFry is the address, and on Second Life. Let's talk about a little about insect communications, and in particular, you write about the communication of honeybees. And I just thought that was so fascinating about how the dances of honeybees, and they do it all in the dark. How do they do that? Well, Bert, you want to talk about how do they do this?
Well, this is the great discovery of Carl von Frisch, you know, the Nobel laureate and my scientific grandfather, by the way. He discovered that the bees express the distance and the direction of a newly discovered food source by a dance. And as long as they can see the sun or the polarized light in the sun, they dance in direction of where the food source is. But of course, bees live in dark cavities, and they have to translate this now onto a different reference system, and they use gravity. So instead of when they say dance 40 degrees to the right of the sun, they do this 40 degrees right to the vertical line, the gravity line, in the nest. It was no one ever disputed that these bees can dance and have the information, but it was disputed once in the United States by a colleague from California that the bees don't use this information, and it still shows up. But by now, so much evidence. The trouble was, von Frisch couldn't do a dummy, could not have a dummy dance and give wrong information to see whether the bees fly there. Mm-hmm. But by now, many experiments have shown this, and it's hard to understand why still some people doubt it. On the other hand, it's hard to understand why evolution should evolve such a complicated system, not to be used.
And if it's done in the dark, how do they communicate?
They follow the bees, the recruits, which follow the dancing bee, hold close antennal contact, and they perceive. And this is not quite clear yet, but it is probably multimodal. They perceive the wind current created by the dancing bee because she waggles with the abdomen, and she produces a sound, a vibrating sound, which is transmitted through the comb and perceived by the follow bees in the legs. They have very, very sensitive vibration organs in their legs. So this is most likely the perception. We don't know yet. But what was recently discovered, no one knew. It was very clear how they indicate direction, but no one knew how they measure distance. How do they know how far they flew? And there was a great discovery by Harald Esch from Notre Dame. He discovered the bees which fly out to the food source register and measure the optical flow, mm-hmm. how fast the lantern posts. It's like you driving in a car and measuring the distance you have driven on the frequency and the fastness lantern post pass by. And this is now very well established, and they showed it very convincingly. For example, they had a bee flying through a tunnel where they had lots of stripes, and the bee flew only 30 meters through the tunnel, but this was for the bee 100 meters.
I see.
Because the optical flow.
Measured the flow of the
atmosphere. That's right. And so you see, this was also the test that this information works, because now they could look whether the recruits who had not to fly through the tunnels, and they removed the tunnels, show up 100 meters away, and they did.
Interesting.
So, and no bee was there before.
Wow.
So this is why we covered it, because it was in the last couple of years. In my view, a beautiful piece of work.
Dr. Wilson, you talk about similar work with the ants. Actually, they measure how many steps they take, and you put them on stilts to prove that?
Yes, we didn't, but some very ingenious experimenters did. You can put the ants up on stilts by adding a very light filament to their legs, and so that they're now walking farther off the ground, so that when they take a stride, they think they're walking a much shorter distance than they actually are. And conversely, you can trim a little part of the leg off. Ants don't notice those things the way we do, incidentally. sure enough, the ants would think that they had gone much farther than they had actually gone. So that's one way of dealing with how ants perceive distance.
It seems like you need
that's right. I should add, we're talking now about ants on the ground, and ants that cannot follow trails but actually are a kind of desert ant that orients entirely by visual signs.
Because you do talk about the ants that use, they lay down a scent trail.
When
right?
they lay down a scent trail, there's not a lot of problem in measuring distance.
And you talk about the collectiveness of the ants. So many ants go back and forth that eventually one finds the shortest trail. They follow that shortest trail.
Yeah.
I would think that to be a successful scientist here, you need two things. You need a lot of things, but one is great patience. And if you're going to put ants on stilts, you've got to have some great patience to do that. And you've not only that, you have to have, as you say, some genius in figuring out how to measure these things.
You have to love your ants.
I think I'm glad you said that, Bert.
You have to love your ants.
When you love the subject and you take a group of organisms like the ants or fruit flies or even those wiggly, inconspicuous little roundworms, Caenorhabditis elegans, you must have an intense interest in them, which is emotional in part. That's why we use this expression, beauty, elegance, and its fascination with that and the endless depth of it that's been achieved by millions of years of evolution that compels the naturalistic scientist, the one who wants to study the full array of adaptations that created that entity. You want to know it all.
And when did you develop, how did you know when you had that? When did you develop that you loved or know that you loved the ant?
Well, there's a photograph taken of Bert Holdover at the age of 13 in Germany looking into a butterfly net as part of his fascination with insects. And there's a strangely similar photograph of me, the same age, in Mobile, Alabama, holding a butterfly net, looking into it. And I think that was about the time that Bert and I really were on our way into studying not just insects, but we were also at that time already developing a special interest in ants.
Mm-hmm. And when did you first meet and decide that you...
Well, this photograph in so far was very interesting. I am a Bavarian, so I stand there with my lederhosen, and Ed, being a Southern of Alabama, has his blue jeans. We met many, many years later at Harvard. I was a visiting scholar in 69 to 71 and met this Southern gentleman, and he was my host. But I never thought, I will come back. I returned to Germany, took a professorship, and then it happened I came back 73 to the faculty of Harvard, and we then over the years developed this friendship. You have to like each other when you write the ants.
You both have to be happy about it.
Yeah, because the ants is such a torturous work. You really have to like each other to go through this torture. And we sometimes wonder how we ever did it, but it was just this continuously sitting together, having lunch, talking, and developing these thoughts. And this friendship now, we know each other 40 years now, became more and more intense. And, this is the next product of this friendship, it's a superorganism.
Mm-hmm. And when did you decide, Ed, going back to the 1970s when your book Sociobiology came out, it caused quite a commotion. We've talked about this I remember being at the meeting where you in the 70s, we got water dumped on your head as a speaker for daring to have these thoughts about genetics and sociology.
Yes.
What moved you to move from the ant colonies to make that leap?
Well, this was a side project of mine, and excuse me a moment. Pardon me. This was a side project of mine, which was to try to synthesize and cover everything known about all social behavior and all kinds of animals, and to put it on a foundation of another discipline, which was population biology. And when I did that, I covered the social insects, of course, and a number of other social organisms. And all that was safe, but at the time I naively said, well, I've got to include humans, we're social, and I started then extending some of the basic principles and suggesting that there was such a thing as a genetic human nature and that this is what really held us together and made us happy and made us collegial and work and sacrifice together. And that didn't go over very well with a lot of people at the time because the blank slate model of the brain that everything in human behavior is based on learning and on the accidents of cultural evolution. Mm-hmm. That was a dominant paradigm. So I ran into trouble. And, I think something came out of the fight.
Are you still feeling any repercussions today?
No, I don't want to sound overly confident, but I think long ago that debate was settled. There is a genetic human nature.
Is there still bad blood, though?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, some of the people who you might have offended you and you had to stick up for yourselves, is there still any bad blood?
Not on my part.
No. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Kevin in St. Augustine, Florida. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call. I think you have the best program on public radio news. I really enjoy it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Your guests are talking about a superorganism acting like a single organism, and that the and that it must work through a cascade of events. But I'm wondering if they have any evidence of an instantaneous shared awareness of some kind of a group mind or collective mind.
Ed Burke, good question. I'm sure that's on the mind of everybody listening.
Very good question indeed, and I wished I have a clear answer to that. It is very difficult to talk about a mind in ants, although I must say I don't doubt it. We have no proof for that. We cannot quantitatively measure what ants. But one thing is common in the ants. They are very tightly connected by chemical means, and each superorganism, each colony. Each member recognizes each other by chemical means to be a member of this society, and they fiercely discriminate against other societies of the same species which have a different chemical uniform. So here is but interestingly, these signals are learned.
Yeah.
The ant is not born with a knowledge of their genetic relatedness. This is once they are eclosing and are young adults, in the first 8 days, they learn the colony odor and they adopt the colony odor. Now, it's too complicated to say explain where the colony odor comes from. But unfortunately, and this is true, we have to just face it. It was denied long in the 70s. Wherever you find social systems in nature that they evolved, you find also the discrimination against members of other social systems of the same species. So xenophobia, unfortunately, we humans are not free from that. In Stone Age, it was adaptive. Groups had to compete for limited resources. We have means of having group recognition, accents, dress, and so on. It's also learned. Now, I immediately want to stress, citing David Hume, what is does not justify the ought. Mm-hmm. We have a good brain, and we should very early educate our children that diversity is in. However, we shouldn't get rid entirely of xenophobia. We may not enjoy a football game. Mm-hmm. You enjoy only a football game by taking sides. And this is... But this... In the ants, of course, they are the ultimate example of discrimination against members of other societies.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's interesting. I only have about less than a minute left. Ed, did you find that people try to extend the analogy too far into humans when you talk about insects?
They used to, Ira. But I think that our understanding of animal behavior, including insect behavior, and as we've just seen nicely illustrated in the studies of the spread of happiness in humans. This has become so sophisticated that we can do better than just making analogies from one to the other.
Mm. What's next project between the two of you? Have you got another book in the works, idea in the works?
Well, we see a lot of each other. We don't have anything. He's out at Arizona, and I like to go out there, and I hope to see ants because they're active all year round, and Cambridge, Massachusetts, has a distinctive dearth of ants, so I think that alone will bring us together in the future.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Talking with Bert Holdobler and E.O. Wilson, authors of The Superorganism, The Beauty, Elegance, and the Strangeness of Insect Societies, a beautiful as well as beautifully written book, and I highly recommend it for holiday. Thank you both for coming into New York and taking time to be with us today. That's about all the time we have for this hour and for this week. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today, of course, as always, from NPR librarian Kim Maleski. If you'd like to send us mail the classic way, we still like to get those letters. Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. And you can reach us on our website at sciencefriday.com, and where we're blogging and podcasting and Twittering and any other thing that we can think of social networking, we're going to try to do it. And we have our video pick of the week. Flora's got the video pick of the week up there. X-ray photographs, really interesting X-ray photographs up there on our website today at sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.